A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
The following podcast contains explicit language and content that may not be suitable for all listeners. Attorney and victims advocate John Ray held a symposium on the Long Island serial killer case, and it stirred up controversy.
I mean, either you have an alibi or you don't.
And he raised some interesting points.
We don't know when these women died. We know when they disappeared.
But the big reveal involves someone very familiar to this story.
She's absolutely certain it was James Burke.
And we talked to a source who connects him to Rex Heuermann.
We saw him in the news, and the first thing I said to my boyfriend was, "Oh shit, that's the hunter."
From ID and Joke Productions, this is Unraveled, Long Island Serial Killer. On January 30th, 2024, John Ray, attorney for the Shannon Gilbert estate, and arguably one of the loudest voices for justice in the case of the Long Island serial killer, hosted a symposium at St. John University on Long Island. The purpose, as he told me, was to lay out his case, the evidence he's gathered, not piecemeal, but in one setting. The event lasted almost 4 hours, and he still wasn't able to cover everything.
With that, I'd also introduce Mr. John Ray.
As expected, a big chunk of the information was in regards to Shannon Gilbert, which is something we'll explore in a future episode because there are a lot of new pieces we haven't yet covered here. But this episode will focus on the largest bombshell to come out of the event, a possible connection between James Burke, the disgraced former Suffolk County Chief of Police, who's been alleged to have slow-rolled the Long Island serial killer investigation, and Rex Heuermann, the man who stands accused of 4 murders associated with that investigation.
The connection between them can mean anything, but it's a first step in a direction toward the point that they're acting in common regarding sex workers.
If you haven't listened to our earlier episodes on James Burke, please make sure to do so, as it will help make sense of what we'll be covering. Later, we'll also share an interview I conducted with an independent source, whose story not only bolsters that potential Burke-Heuermann connection, but brings insight into the dark, pervasive attitudes towards sex workers that permeated Long Island life. But first, there was something else John Ray presented at the symposium that caused quite a stir. Never a stranger to controversy, this time he involved Asa Ellerup, wife of Rex Heuermann, and their children.
New evidence, meantime, could be coming today. The Gilgo Beach murder case. An attorney represents the family of the victims, planning to reveal the details on that.
We have five bombshells from the event hosted by an attorney for some of the Gilgo Beach victims.
The accusations that John Ray has been raising recently in a symposium. Was Asa Elrup in town or out of town? Does her alibi, in fact, stand up that she was not there when her husband allegedly committed these crimes?
And according to John Ray, there's a whole lot more to this story than we're aware of.
In fact, John Ray's statement traveled at the speed of light all over the world, prompting Ves Mitev, the attorney for the Huerman children, to give the following quote to the U.S. Sun. Quote, "I guess in America, anyone can say anything about anyone. But rambling, unhinged, and inflammatory statements are especially dangerous because it endangers the health, safety, and welfare of people who want nothing to do with any of this except to move on with their lives," end quote. At the center of all the drama is District Attorney Ray Tierney's bail application, which was filed with the charges for the murder of Maureen Brainerd Barnes, which we covered in our last episode. D.A. Tierney stated that travel and cell phone records reveal that Asa Elrup and the kids were out of the state during the time periods Melissa Bartholomew, Megan Waterman, and Amberlyn Costello all went missing. The disappearance of Maureen Brainerd Barnes occurred a full 3 years before the Gilgo Four were found along Ocean Parkway. And it looks like, perhaps, there wasn't any cell phone evidence to prove where Asa Elrup and the kids were at that time. But there was a bank statement recovered from Rex Huerman's storage unit after his arrest. And it showed the family took a trip to Atlantic City during that time, the month of July in 2007. This is important. You don't want to miss this. The big date to remember is July 9th, 2007. That's the last time Maureen Brainerd Barnes was heard from. We've established that the Huerman family owned and vacationed at timeshares, and the bank statement shows three hotel stays, which were timeshare hotels, about a week each, during July of 2007. The bank statement shows a transaction at the flagship hotel on July 14th in the amount of $37.45, posted to the account on July 17th. But the statement also lists the words, quote, "arrival date, July 6th, 2007, end quote. July 6th would be before Maureen Brainerd Barnes was last seen or heard from. This bank statement and an alleged interview between Asa Elrup and investigators corroborating that she was in fact in Atlantic City at that time led District Attorney Ray Tierney to state the following.
The family had checked into a hotel in Atlantic City July 6th of 2007, and they remained there till approximately July 20th of 2007. And both the documentary evidence as well as witness statements have indicated that during the time of Maureen Brainerd Barnes' disappearance in July, on or about July 9th of 2007, Huerman was not with his family. He joined them sometime thereafter.
So what's John Ray's problem with this? Why did this become an issue? While in the press conference, Ray Tierney committed to the family checking into the hotel on July 6th, in the actual bail document filed with the court, the writing is less certain. Quote, "Mrs. Elrup and her two children stayed in Atlantic City, New Jersey from on or about July 6th, 2007 through on or about July 20th, 2007, end quote. Here's what John Ray told me.
As soon as I looked at that evidence, I said, wait, let me read this a little more carefully. He said they were gone on or about. That's the phrase he used. On or about July 6th, and came back on or about July 20th. Now, when you're dealing with pleadings where you want to cover yourself in case you're wrong about the exact date, you say so-and-so crashed his car on or about blank, whatever date. It's a standard attorney phrase for pleadings, which are fungible. It's not a standard attorney phrase for alibis. I mean, either you have an alibi or you don't. It's not on or about. On or about takes away the alibi. So I said, let's call the hotel and ask them what these things mean. So I, with three witnesses who were working on the case with me, called the hotel. We finally got the hotel manager. I said, can you just tell me, do you have any records that go back to 2007? She said, yeah, of course we do. I said, can you look and see what the actual check-in time was for these people? Sure. So she went back. I said, look up, please, Rex Hoyerman. She looked everywhere. She said, no, he's not in this, not there. I said, okay, can you look for Ellerup, the name Ellerup? She goes, oh, yeah, here it is right here. It's Asa. She called it Asa. It's Asa Ellerup. She read off the bill, and she read the exact amount of the bill just as it was sitting in front of us from Tierney's filing. And it said, check-in date was July 17th, 2007, and check-out date was July 23rd. We took it through the whole process twice to make sure that what we had was right.
Now, this conversation, if accurate, is concerning for many reasons, not the least of which is the hotel sharing this information with anyone other than law enforcement. On January 31st, the day after the John Ray Symposium, Vesmitev, the attorney for the Huerman children, sent a letter to the flagship hotel and its parent company demanding to see records, call logs, the name of the hotel manager, and a clear understanding of the company's privacy policies. He maintains that his clients were out of town and questions the validity of John Ray's statement. To be fair, if this new information is correct, with a check-in date of July 17th, then the July 14th transaction of 3745 still requires explanation. There doesn't seem to be a clear, simple timeline here. But the other reason this is a big deal is that prosecutors stated, quote, based on the foregoing, the murders of all four victims occurred at times when Defendant Huerman's wife and children were traveling out of state, which allowed Defendant Huerman unfettered time to execute his plans for each victim without any fear that his family would uncover his involvement in these crimes, end quote. As John Ray points out,
it's a hell of a lot easier to go forward with his trials on the evidence they have against him by isolating him and his cases, and thereby discarding people who are not crucial to their proving his guilt.
But because Asa Ellerup corroborated to investigators the bank statement with its posted Atlantic City arrival date on July 6, 2007, if that date turns out not to be correct, then John Ray says we have a problem.
You have to draw the reasonable inference that she's lying to the district attorney.
Of course, it could also be that she was simply mistaken about the dates. After all of this occurred almost 17 years ago. The investigators are painting a pretty clear picture with travel records, including passport stamps in and out of the country, as well as cell phone records for the other, later three Gilgo 4 murders. It's not a stretch to assume that Asa and the kids were also out of town at the time Maureen Brainerd Barnes disappeared, whether that bank statement turns out to be a solid piece of evidence or not. But John Ray makes another point that we haven't really discussed.
We don't know when these women died. We know when they disappeared. And so one says, okay, well, then what? Why shouldn't you assume it's reasonable that they died when they disappeared? Okay, but that's not proven. Look, Hoyerman, he indulges in torture pornos. Apparently, that's what he gets off on. Now, if he's a torturer, you don't torture dead people. You can only torture live people. And that's where you get your pleasure. So you have to keep them alive. If he likes it that much, maybe he keeps them alive for a while. It's a reasonable possibility that they did not die when they disappeared. Then we don't know the real parameters of the alibi.
That's a scary but factual thought. The remains were found long after they were placed along Ocean Parkway and exposed to the elements for a long period of time. It is doubtful that forensics could pinpoint an exact time or even exact date of death. But when it comes to Asa, many believe that while she may have been aware of her husband's sexual proclivities, that doesn't necessarily mean that she was aware of any more nefarious behavior. Court documents show that investigators watched Rex Huerman and his family for over a year. If Asa or the kids showed any signs of being more involved, would the district attorney go out of his way to state their innocence? John Ray, though, feels like the matter hasn't been thoroughly investigated.
I think that if they had other things that ruled out the mother and the children, they would have come forward with them and said so in that application. there's one innocent explanation, and there are many guilty explanations. How about they investigate and stop trying to cover up these people?
It's about 4 weeks since my revelation at the symposium about the hotel. Where are the deniers? It was Ntev and Macedonia both who saying they were going to get the information to show I was a liar. 4 weeks have gone by, nothing. And why is the DA silent on it?
We'll surely hear more about this in the weeks to come. We also reached out to Vesmitev directly and have not heard back from his office. Of course, the John Ray revelation that caught all of our attention was the affidavit he presented from an Alice Poe. Per her request, her identity has been withheld from the public. Her story is the first public alleged connection between Rex Yuerman and James Burke, the two men whose names will be forever connected to the case of the Long Island serial killer.
She indicates that when she was a girl of about 18 years old and had dropped out of high school, she was living at a motel in Patchogue, and she was befriended by a sex worker who had a baby, and the sex worker convinced her to go to a party in a room, not a bedroom, but in a room at that motel. And she went to the party, and in the party were all these men, and the sex worker eventually left. The girl got really scared. She was there all by herself, and the reason she got scared was that there was a man who was a police man, and he was happily lighting a crack pipe, and in a ritualistic sort of way, he had the men line up, and they'd come up to him and take a hit of the crack, and then the next guy would step up and so on, and he was enjoying himself. She's absolutely certain it was James Burke, and this went on for some time, but she didn't want to be there, and she went outside on the pretension that she was going to smoke a cigarette. The men had continued to go in and out, standing out there leaning against the wall in a fashion that his back was up against the wall and his legs were extended at a 45-degree angle, so you couldn't see his true height, was a very large man. And it turned out to be Herman. He and the men were looking at a fancy car that had come. She talked to this guy, and he seemed friendly and nice, and then everything shifted and changed. And he put his arm around her and tried to hold her firmly and guide her away from the car and over towards the building. And she had to talk her way fast. She told him she had to go get her cigarettes in her room, which is right there, and she'd be right back. And he let her go. And by the way, you might say, oh, that doesn't sound like him. That's exactly him, because I have several other statements who said the same thing, that he let them go. He didn't kill everybody that he had sex with. He had sex with hundreds and hundreds of people. So this is not a surprise. But she was so intimidated by him, she went in and locked her door. And then somebody came and knocked on her door twice, and she didn't answer it. And that's the end of her story. But it does connect, if she's right, Burke and Herman.
As we've covered in the early episodes of this podcast, James Burke has been found by the Suffolk County Police Department's Internal Affairs to have had a relationship with a sex worker, engaging in sexual acts in his police vehicle while on duty. And during his sentencing for civil rights violations and obstruction of justice, his history with sex workers and drugs came to light in the courtroom.
Burke has a predilection for sex workers. I represented one of them. She described how at a place, a house that he seemed to have control of in Ronkonkoma, he would take her regularly where they would smoke crack together. So the crack piece fits in quite with this other girl who didn't know what I just told you.
What John Ray didn't know then is that I've been communicating with an independent source whose story has many similarities. This source and I connected before the symposium. Her story next.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
On January 15th, we received an email to the Unravel tip line Gmail account. It stated, quote, "I don't know if this is nothing, but I also don't know if it's something," end quote. The email was from a female, worried about her name being exposed. Not sure if what she had experienced was worth sharing. Quote, "I don't think I'm going to be much help considering he's in jail," end quote. She was referring to Rex Huerman. I've interviewed quite a few women who had strange or disturbing experiences with Rex Huerman, but what made this email stand out is she also referenced James Burke. Quote, "I also know Burke," end quote. I reached out and started building some trust and vetting her stories. We're keeping her name anonymous per her request. This is her story from when she lived on Long Island.
I went away to school and I had moved back. I just went to a bar in town and saw these people I graduated high school with. And like, oh my gosh, we all started reconnecting that night. You know, they were all still in town.
Early spring of 2009?
At that point, it was like 2010 already.
This is before we even knew there was a Long Island serial killer, because those revelations were made in the winter of 2010.
It started because I had this one friend who, growing up, his dad like had a limo company. My friend was selling drugs, like a lot of drugs, all over Long Island, like all over the country. He'd go to many places, and so he's just like not a nice kid. But, you know, I kind of fell into that whole weird, I guess, group. I went to this party, and it was just like filled with like old people, you know, older people than us. I wasn't even 20 yet. I was still 19.
Can you explain how and why you guys ended up at these parties with these older people?
My friend's dad would always be at these parties. Like, I don't know if he's friends with them or how he's friends with them, or if it was just through like the limo company. He had all these friends, and my friend would get called because he had the younger friends. He had like the drugs. We would roll up and we'd have a bunch of drugs. Kind of an exchange of like drugs, alcohol, people. Like, it was weird.
Talk about when you started to realize that there was a cop at some of these parties and when you realized who his name was, how often it was, just anything you can remember about any of that.
So I remember like seeing like him before knowing who he was. Like the day I found out who he was exactly, someone walked in and said, oh, that guy Jimmy Burke, the police was here. And I got nervous because I'm like, what? Like, the cops are here? And then my friend was like, no. Like, it's okay. Don't worry, but do you know who I am? Like, we're all good. We don't have anything to worry about.
So to be clear, Burke, having been there at these parties, would have had some idea about the drug use involved at the parties and your friend dealing drugs among the party. Like, this would have been something Burke would have had to be aware of if he was there?
1,000%. Like, this was not something that was, like, hidden.
So what was your impression of James Burke before you realized he was a cop?
He's really personable. He's like a Long Island guy. You know, he could literally talk to anyone. He knows everyone. He's very personable. And, like, I didn't have, like, in-depth conversations with him that much. He seemed friendly enough to, like, be comfortable around him.
Did you think it was weird, your friend's relationship with this cop?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was weird, but I thought it was, like, kind of cool, I guess, that we didn't have to worry. You got to admit, like, the thought of that as a 19, 20, 21-year-old, like, I can do that shit, you feel like, this is, like, exciting.
There's a particular interaction with James Burke that she recalls that still haunts her today.
It was one night we were at one of the parties, and, you know, like, Burke, he was just, like, making conversation with everyone in motion, and he gave me a pipe. Before I even could say no to the pipe he offered, like, my friend's dad was like, no, not these kids. I guess that was, like, why is some police officer doing this? And my friend's dad is the one telling you to, like, not do something stupid. Like, what the fuck?
Do you know what kind of drugs they were doing that night?
Fucking crack, for sure. They all were, like, a bunch of them were. It wasn't, like, a hidden thing. Like, they didn't try to hide it. Nobody tried to hide it, ever.
So whoever was smoking out of this pipe, you believe they were smoking crack?
Yeah, 100%.
As with John Ray's witness, and the previous former sex worker he represented, crack is a reoccurring drug in these personal testimonies. Our source also places James Burke at a very specific location, a strip club called The Oasis in Smithtown, Long Island.
He would go to The Oasis sometime, and Burke was 100% there. I know very clear in my mind twice for sure, and, like, nothing crazy happened those nights when he was there and I was there that I could think of, but Kitchy Chick goes on to that place all the time, and, like, the same girls that you would see, like, dancing and stuff would end up being at some of these parties.
So The Oasis, if you have to explain it to someone who's never been there, the look, the vibe, like, how would you describe it? What is it like in there?
Yeah, it's this little building. It looks like a house. It looks like somebody's home. The only bathroom in the front is for men. Like, if girls are there and have to use the bathroom, you have to hopefully, like, one of the dancers will let you use it. Like, it's a sketchy place. Hold on. I need to take some water. I'm like, I don't know. I just feel, like, so much shame around this stuff. I don't know. Like, such a weird position in my life. You know, like, it's just weird to, like, look back on. Their whole lives are so brought down to just, like, what they did for, like, their bodies in a way. And it's, like, I don't know. It just makes me uncomfortable to know the fact that these girls had to go through that. And these men took advantage of, like, the situations that they were in and their bodies. And they're, like, you know, how naive we all were. We were young. Like, no grown woman wants to be around those people. No grown woman wants to be in that situation. And, like, it hurts to know that, like, even though, thank God, nothing happened to me ever. Like, I was around this shit that anything could have gone terribly wrong. I don't talk to any of these people anymore. So, like, I hope they're all okay. But, like, I have no way of knowing. Like, does anyone have any way of knowing if they're okay at this point?
I'd like to take a moment to talk about The Oasis and the women who work there. The Oasis Gentlemen's Club had operated under a few different names since its launch in 1979 and took up some prime real estate next to the Smithtown Bull, which is a statue at the fork of the Jericho Turnpike, a historical landmark of a metal bull named Whisper. From the outside, the Oasis looks like a nondescript building. There is brick, there is siding, and an unpaved parking lot. According to some reviews we found online, the place was, quote, pretty good. A little pricey, though, for a lap dance. $60 for 10 minutes, $100 for 15 minutes, and $175 for 30, end quote. Another reviewer said, quote, I've been hanging out at the Oasis for the past 10 years now, and it's definitely Smithtown's best-kept secret. Oasis houses some of the most beautiful girls on Long Island, not to mention the droves of Russian girls they get from Brooklyn, end quote. The township of Smithtown purchased the Oasis in 2021 for the price of $815,000. Residents apparently were sick of it. The purchase received unanimous support
of the town board. But those in the adult entertainment industry claim that the owner was forced to sell or be subject to eminent domain claim, with the city taking this land no matter what. Here's the thing. I lived in Smithtown throughout my entire childhood and drove by the Oasis every day on my way to high school. Growing up, it was elusive to me. But my high school guy friends would crack jokes about wanting to go there when they turned 18. I called one of those friends to see if he could tell me what the Oasis was actually like.
Tell me all about Oasis.
Security was always pretty tight. Like, even as adults, like, they were very hard on IDs. And then you'd get inside and it would be, like, basically empty. The girls were, like, strung out, drug addict white girls. But there would be a lot of them that were, like, from Russia or, like, some sort of Soviet country. As far as, like, clientele goes, it was definitely a mixed bag. Like I said, there was never that many people there, but it was usually, like, seedy old white dudes. In fairness, anytime I was there was, like, the end of a night. Like, it was, I was never there for, like, normal prime time drinking hours.
When you walk in, is it like there's a bar? So, it looks like a house. Like, it's a very unassuming place to be a strip club.
If you're looking at the front of the house, the entrance is on the right-hand side. There's a parking lot, and, like, the side door is the entryway to the club. When that door opens, you enter, and the stage is directly to your right. So you, like, walk past the stage to get to the bar, and the bar was on the, like, opposite wall. If you turn to your left, there's all, like, seating, and then across the room that way is, like, the room where you would get, like, a lap dance.
How big was it? Like, how many people did it look like could fit in there?
The whole thing was maybe 1,000 square feet. It was, like, the size of, like, a decent-sized apartment. There definitely were, like, other rooms that, I think there was, like, an upstairs of some sorts that was, like, the office. I never went back there. I do remember, like, people coming and going up a staircase in the back, but, like, I have no idea what was up there.
Next, we get back to our source and the alleged interaction between James Burke and Rex Huerman that she witnessed. Our source spent a few years in her late teens, early 20s, on the Long Island party scene. A friend of hers brought her to these parties, frequented by older participants, including James Burke and also Rex Huerman. I asked her what she thought when she saw the news of his arrest for the Gilgo 4 murders.
We saw him in the news, and the first thing I said to my boyfriend was, oh shit, that's the hunter. So my friend that I was speaking of, well, all the guys, they all love hunting, and, like, they would go upstate, they would go all over and go on these, like, hunting trips, and they'd be gone for, like, 4, 5, 6 days at a time.
To clarify, the same group of men that were friends with your friend's dad, the mm-hmm. same group of men at this party, they were just a group of hunters.
Yeah, I don't know if they all were, but yeah, definitely. Like, I know, like, my friend, his dad, two of his friends that were always at the party were hunters. Like, they always went hunting together. And then, like, other people, they would, like, talk about that.
You saw the picture in the news. You go, oh, my God, that's the hunter. So explain how you knew that he was the hunter. Like, when did that nickname come into use?
One of the first parties that we went to, like, Rex was there. For sure. And I know this because my friend's dad, like, introduced us all to him. And then my friend said, oh, we go hunting. He looks like he would go hunting, Rex. Like, I don't know. He just looked, like, barbaric. He wasn't mean or anything. He hadn't said anything mean. He was a huge man and a scary man at that. And that was it. He was just, like, a hunter in my mind.
So you met Rex through your friend's dad, and you met Burke through your friend's dad. Did those two, Burke and Rex, end up at the same parties, per your recollection?
So there was one, well, I know for sure. They were just, like, talking, like, in the distance. I wasn't paying attention to it. Like, they were just casually talking in the distance. they had an exchange, and it wasn't like it was a negative one or a pot, like nothing. It just looked, they said words and then they like motioned to each other, like nodded heads, and then like walked away from each other. And I don't remember what else happened. Like, you know, like the party just kept going on. Nobody, it wasn't like a big day. That's like what I know for sure. I know other nights where just Rex was there at that point because, you know, like I didn't say hi to him, but like I would be like, oh, there's Under. Like, okay, that means this. Like you would associate him with like, oh, this group of people must be there, like be here tonight, you know, like whoever these guys were.
And then he just started to become the hunter. Is that because like when your friend's dad introduced you to Rex, like he was like, that's my hunting buddy or something?
Yeah, it was something like somebody like, we go hunting together, or this is my hunting friend. And then like, I just called him the hunter, never to his face. Like, no, never that. I don't know. I just, maybe because I wasn't good with names when I was younger, like everyone, when I would meet them, like had like an association, and that was his.
When you saw Rex's face on the news, how did you know for sure that it was the hunter?
You just like, don't forget that face. And like, I had seen him enough times to know, like, once I saw the face, I was like, oh shit, like that's my friend's dad's friend. Like, that's this. Like, once I put it, was like, oh my God, that's this guy.
After a couple years in this party scene, the fun, the excitement she seemed to have had worn off. And she tells us of the last time she ever attended one of these parties.
The last time, like, I ever went to a party, Rex was at that night. It was at, like, a house. My friend was already, like, taking some drugs, so it was, like, already weird. And when we get to this house, it was, like, a much smaller group of people. It was like in the colder months, maybe like a fall. We're all getting messed up. We're all drinking, whatever. And you could see it's like nobody else is coming to this party. Nobody else is coming around. There's nobody like texting like, hey, where are you at? Like nothing. So it was like weird. And there was this one girl who was there and like definitely wasn't from New York because she had an accent. And she said something like, bless your heart. Like, what are you guys doing here? She was a little bit older than us. Like, mid-20s, maybe. I remember, like, Rex was, like, laser-focused on her, and I only know that for sure because there was, like, not that many people there. All of a sudden, you heard, like, a clatter, and this girl comes out of the room, and she's, like, looks scared or, like, annoyed, mostly scared. A little while later, like, 45 minutes, an hour goes by, and you just hear, like, a blood-curdling scream, and, like, she's like, no, no, absolutely no, please no. She came out of the room and she like looked terrified, and she just sat there on the couch and she like didn't move, nothing. All her arms were crossed and she was scared. And I couldn't find my friend at that point. And I'm like, what's going on? Like, are you okay? And one of the older guys was like yelling at me to like, shut up. Like, none of my business. It's none of my business. Why is she screaming? Now she's not talking. She's not answering anyone's questions. Like, I'm bugging out. My friend, he was with some girl somewhere, and I like, I just was uncomfortable. I was like sitting on a couch, this old guy yelling at me to mind my own business, like, and I just like couldn't be there anymore. I called my friend who had like no ties to these people whatsoever from Long Island, though, like, but like from a different town, and they came and like picked me up. As I'm waiting for them, it was like 30 minutes until they were gonna get there. My friend finally comes out and was like, you okay? Like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm just gonna go home. Like, I'm really tired. Like, I'll call you tomorrow. Nobody else seemed concerned that this girl was like screaming like that. Like, nobody opened the door. Like, this guy yelling at me to shut up. She's fine. She said she's fine. Like, walk away, walk away, walk away. I was like, oh my God, I gotta get the fuck out of here. And like, I never went back. These are just not people I want in my life.
So that was like the final straw for you?
Yeah. I felt very alone. I felt in danger. Like, I truly did. All the times I was partying with them, like, I never felt the need to leave. Like, no matter what, I felt really just like nobody was going to care if anything happened to me either. Like, something obviously happened to her. So I was like, I just got to get out of there. I feel really trapped. Like, I'm fucked if anything happens. Like, I'm fucked. I'm alone. I was like, alone.
Her story gives a unique insider perspective into these parties, while also lining up with previous witness statements. Whether Rex Huerman and James Burke were anything more than two men who may have traveled in the same circles, we don't know. I did ask John Ray if the Oasis Gentlemen's Club ever showed up in his investigation, and here's what he had to say.
The Oasis Club in Smithtown, your hometown, was notorious. It's closed now, but it was a notorious center of sexual perversion. I remember that it was a off-limits place. You wouldn't go there unless you were into that kind of stuff. Everybody knew it. Everybody knew what it was. In fact, there was a raid upon the Oasis conducted by the fire department and the local police. After the raid took place, they got hit with a bunch of fire violations and safety violations, not with any criminal arrests, because there was no law that they could think of that they were violating with the sex. But there was a list of 140 people who were there, 140, many of whom were very prominent people. And that list we've asked for by way of a FOIA, and they've refused it to us so far.
FOIA stands for Freedom of Information Act, a process with which the public and journalists can request government documents.
We're doing a lot of legwork on the Oasis and on the people who went there that we do know about. The amount of time I put in has generated some fruit out of the Oasis. I have more than I've told everybody about the Oasis and about the people who were there and what they were doing there and with whom. And I have a lot of that. There's definitely a girl who was a heroin addict who worked there as a stripper, and she disappears and she's found in Lake Ronkonkoma.
For me, one of the most disturbing aspects of all of this and all of these accounts is the lack of respect or care for women and sex workers in general. I understand that this was before the 2016 Me Too scandals, but that said, it doesn't take a genius to see that this pervasive attitude towards women not only contributed to the deaths of the Gilgo Four, but may very well explain why solving the crime didn't become a priority until 2021, when the task force was formed. I had one more question for our source.
If you could estimate how many people saw Rex Heuermann and James Burke together, what would you estimate?
At least a dozen. I know at least a dozen. For sure.
If you were one of those dozen people, please reach out to Suffolk County Law Enforcement. If you don't feel comfortable with that, you can always email us at unraveltips@gmail.com, or you can contact me directly on Instagram at Alexis Linkletter. Before we go, there's one last thing I'd like to say. We are so grateful for the continued support we've received from all of you over the last 9 months. And we're excited to announce that in June and July of 2024, we'll be releasing a series of deep dive episodes that will be released weekly instead of monthly. Get ready for more in-depth investigation into all things having to do with the Long Island serial killer case. If you have a question, theory, or subject that you'd like us to cover, you can email us, as always, at unraveledtips@gmail.com. Or you can contact me directly on Instagram at Alexis Linkletter. Unraveled is produced by Joke Productions 4ID. The executive producers and writers of this podcast are Joke Finciune, Biagio Messina, and myself, Alexis Linkletter. Executive producer for ID is Annie Mangoni. Our editor is Caitlin Cleveland. Lisa Rybakov is our associate producer. The music and score that you've heard in this podcast is by Biagio Messina. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. It helps a lot when you subscribe, rate, and review the podcasts that you enjoy listening to. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.